We are now several weeks into the Crown of Glory series. We're journeying in this series through Lent, leading up to Easter in a couple of weeks. And the overall premise for the series has been this. The whole point of the Gospels is to tell the story of how Israel's God became king on earth as in heaven, which raises one important question, or several. One of them is this. Isn't God already king? I mean, wasn't he already king before Jesus, before the events the gospel writers are telling us? I mean, isn't his kind of like his job description to be the sole sovereign God? That's his position and his status. Yes, it's yes and no. Yes, in some ways, because it's always been God's rightful claim that he is king on earth as in heaven, and he alone. But it's also no in some significant ways, because in a sense, his authority was on earth was actually challenged by us. God's authority was challenged by us, and it changed the whole equation. Genesis chapter 3, the serpent in the garden tempts Adam and Eve to basically challenge God's authority, to question God's right to rule over them, and challenges them to perhaps consider maybe putting God on an equal playing ground, equal field. And so God tells them not to eat from the tree of knowledge in the garden or to even touch it. And the serpent says to them, "For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God." So humanity, in rebellion against God, dares to challenge God's rightful authority in place. And so at its essence, the fall, as theologians call this, in the garden. It's an attempt to usurp. It's an attempt to grab power, to grab authority that was God's alone and was never ours to begin with. And so sin and death are natural consequences of this. Adam and Eve are then exiled out of the garden. Remember God's original command, though, to humanity. What was it? In the garden. They were commanded to steward creation. They were commanded to, in a sense, rule over the created world. To be co-creators with God. In other words, God had given humanity some of his own authority. He had delegated some of his power, some of his authority to us and entrusted us to be faithful with that. What's interesting then, though, in this story is one of the consequences of the fall, one of the consequences that you might expect, but that doesn't actually happen, is we still have this authority. We still have the original command. We still have this delegated ability to steward and to rule. And what's changed is our capacity to do good with that authority. Does that make sense? And so violence and corruption and pride and all these things enter in to the mix. Now, we see this immediately with Cain. Cain fails to steward creation. He fails to be a wise ruler of the world that God had given him. And so instead of stewarding creation, he destroys part of it by murdering his brother Abel. And then he's on the run, and Genesis 4 says, soon after this, Cain fled, and Cain was then building a city. So Cain sets out right on the heels of misusing this power, this delegated authority, and he doesn't want to build a house, he wants to build a whole city. It's like this impulse to build. This impulse to create, to do stuff with creation. It's not lost after the fall. It's still there. It's like in our DNA. It just gets corrupted and abused, and violence enters into the picture. The rebellion continues. It reaches new heights in Genesis chapter 11. The people go to a place on a plain in Babylon, and they say, "Come, let us build ourselves a city." So there it is again. "With a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves." So we're still building stuff, even in exile from Eden. Only we're not building it for God. We're not building it for his glory. It's a monument to our own pride, to our own human accomplishment. So the question, in Genesis chapter 11, is God king on earth in the same way that he's king in heaven? See, for somebody to be king, if you're king of a domain or king of a kingdom, that means that your will is done in that domain. What you want, your agenda, your purpose actually happens because people are listening to you. People are responding, obeying, submitting to you. And so, no, in a tragic sense, God is not, he's the rightful king, but he's been displaced. He's not the king as he should be on earth as he is in heaven. God says, okay, if that's how you want to make a name for yourselves, then go for it. And several generations later, you have the Israelites taken as slaves, as captives, under the rule, under the power and the authority of Pharaoh. See, what happens is when we resist submitting to God, then not only do we subvert his rule, but then we begin doing things for ourselves out of pride, out of arrogance, and eventually we end up ruling each other. Like when this becomes this with God, then we end up ruling over each other in this constant power struggle for power. And so they're under Egyptian slavery in the first chapter of Exodus. So this is the second book of the Bible. So they put slave masters, that's the Egyptians, over them, the Israelites, to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramses as store, what's the word? Cities for Pharaoh. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor and brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. And so Cain, having disobeyed God in Genesis 4, tries to build a city. In Genesis chapter 11, you got the people building a city and then a tower in Babylon. And then the beginning of the second book of the Bible, the Israelites as a whole are building cities for this pagan foreign oppressor, this Pharaoh, who's claimed power and authority over them. These human rulers, as the people in the Bible begin to discover, not only were they working out of their own pride and arrogance, they were actually colluding with the darker forces. The same forces that Adam and Eve signed on with the serpent in the garden and brought destruction and chaos. Those same forces, human rulers, were now aligning themselves with. We're now becoming willing agents of the enemy, of the accuser, or Satan, as he's called in Hebrew. And so the Israelites begin to wrestle with this concept. Okay, God is obviously in control of the world, right? I mean, he should be. He's the earth and everything in it is the Lord's. He's Lord of heaven and on earth, but his rule is being contested. People are subverting his rule. And so what's God going to do? How is he going to respond? And they began to notice that even though people were rebelling, and even though kings were aligning themselves with the powers and the forces of darkness, that God was somehow still entering in. And somehow, in his mercy, was actually working through even people like Pharaoh. That's why you have this tension of Pharaoh doing a lot of bad stuff. He was an evil guy. And at the same time, these scriptures talk about how God was like working somehow through Pharaoh to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish. God sent Moses, and through Moses and the events of the Passover, God basically directly challenges the authority and the power of Pharaoh. You know the whole plagues thing in Egypt? It's like showdown between Yahweh, the one true God, and Pharaoh, who thinks of himself like a god. They cross the Red Sea. They go out into the wilderness. The Egyptian army that's pursuing them in the Red Sea, the waters crash down on them. And once they get to the other side, they look back at this whole scene and what God had rescued them from. And Moses and the Israelites sing this song in Exodus 15. They all join together. They say, I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. Both horse and driver, he has hurled into the sea. And then this is a long song talking about how God brought them deliverance, how God brought them victory. And then it ends with, the Lord reigns forever and ever. The song is saying that God has shown himself to be the rightful king. He's demonstrated that in rescuing them, in giving them victory and deliverance. God reminded Pharaoh through this whole scene, and the Israelites who hadn't figured this out yet, that God is the rightful king. Now, they eventually, after 40 years, get to the promised land, and collective amnesia sets in. The people forget all about this, and in 1 Samuel, they say to God, God, give us a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. And God says, he warns them, if you want this, I just want you to know there's a high price. There's a hidden cost that you might not know about. These kings may come to you and require your cattle. They may ask for the best of your fields and your flocks and your vineyards, all to serve themselves. You might even find yourselves enslaved to a king that you supposedly had to have. I just want you to know. And yet they keep demanding this. And God's saying, not that I want this to happen. these bad things. He just knows us better than we know ourselves. That humanity, east of Eden, has a tendency to corrupt power. And so God says, when that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen. But the Lord will not answer you in that day. And the people are like, no, we know what we're talking about. We insist. We got this. We want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations. And so God reluctantly grants them their king. First Saul, then David, then Solomon. It's important to notice that David's reign, that's seen as the high point in the whole history, in the whole Old Testament story. It seemed like for just a moment, God was going to break in through David's reign. And God was going to establish the rule of heaven on earth. He was going to bring his kingdom and his power on earth as it is in heaven. They started to recognize that for some reason, just like God in the garden had chosen people to carry the project forward, to work with him, they started to wonder if perhaps God would choose a person to fix the mess, that God would choose an agent, a subject, a human to work through, to restore what had been broken and what had been lost in the fall. And they thought that maybe in David, all nations would come to see that Yahweh is God and be drawn to worship him. But that didn't quite happen, did it? Generations later, the kings grew more and more wicked, and the people went along for the ride, and they forgot about God, and it's this long, sad story on repeat. It's the same old story. This, as the prophets had all warned, led to Israel being captured by the Babylonians, taken off into exile. The temple was destroyed. The walls of Jerusalem were completely flattened. Again, there's some irony here, and don't miss this. They're taken back to Babylon, right? Which, when were they in Babylon the first time? Genesis 11, right? Making this tower as a monument to their own pride and arrogance. And they get to that place again, and God again takes them back to Babylon. The cycle is stuck on repeat. After years in exile, a significant number of Israelites eventually do come home to Israel. They return to Israel. They rebuild the walls. They construct a new temple. But those who had lived and seen Solomon's first temple knew it wasn't the same. The former glory wasn't there. Things just aren't what they used to be. I mean, they're not in Babylon. They're home, but it's not what it used to be. Now, this is a huge kind of turn, a hinge point in the sermon. At this point, the people started to look back at the Psalms. They started to look back at the writings of the prophets and to look at them a little bit more closely. And they began to see that perhaps God was going to do something new. Perhaps God was promising to bring a new rescue from their predicament, from their current exile. And so they looked at Psalms like Psalm 89, where God says, "I have made a covenant with my chosen one. I have sworn to David, my servant, I will establish your line forever and make your throne firm through all generations." They begin to ask this question. If this is true, then there's got to be another son of David. There's got to be someone else, a descendant of David, who will rise up and rescue us and free us from Exodus, free us from exile. Psalm 72, which is talking about this son of David who's supposed to come, God says, "Then all nations will be blessed through him," through this son of David figure. "And they will call him blessed." Prophets like Isaiah came along, and they sharpened the focus dramatically on what this Messiah figure, this son of David, would do and how you'd recognize him. Isaiah 42 says, God says, here is my servant. So this son of David is also a servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him, and he will bring justice to the nations. Now, before I read verse 2, think about the story of power that's been told up to this point. Think about the cycles of violence that have escalated and how the rulers of this world have lorded over their subjects. And then contrast that with this picture of this servant. Verse 2, "He will not shout or cry out or raise his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out. In faithfulness he will bring forth justice. He will not falter or be discouraged till he establishes justice on earth," until he makes sure that God is king on earth as he is in heaven. God's reign, God's rule is brought to this earth, his justice and his peace. He goes on and says, I will keep you and I will make you to be a covenant for the people and a light for the Gentiles. That was Israel's original calling. They were always supposed to be a light to the Gentiles. God's saying, through this person, I will make sure that that happens. To open the eyes that are blind, to free captives from prison, to release from the dungeon those who sit in darkness. God, through this son of David, through this servant figure, would bring his peace and his justice and healing to the world. This ruler wouldn't be like the kings and rulers and emperors they'd seen before. This is one who would be known as a servant of all. God, through this Messiah, would be king on earth as in heaven, as was always intended. Now, to fully get what the gospel writers are saying about Jesus, in light of these promises, in light of these hopes, we have to try to put ourselves in their shoes. The Roman Empire in the first century, the superpower of the day, conquers Israel. They begin a long, oppressive occupation of the nation of Israel. Only instead of hauling them away, like to a foreign land, this time the foreign land comes to them, occupies them. Roman soldiers march through their village. Rome enforces high taxation rates so that they can build even bigger armies, so that they can go out with violence and conquer even more nations. The Romans even built a military center right next to the temple in Jerusalem. It was called the Praetorium. And they built it on purpose, intentionally, intentionally, yes. They built it a few feet higher than the temple as a way of reminding the Jewish people every time they went into the temple to worship, hey, we want you to know who's really in charge here. I mean, imagine growing up with that kind of history. Imagine growing up with this heritage that I just walked us through, with that kind of story, and you think your kids have hard questions from time to time for you. Imagine trying to explain to your kids in that setting why these Roman soldiers, people who don't even believe in your God, what it is they're doing on the streets of your village. So this is the beginning of the first century in Israel. Occupation, oppression, shame, and humiliation. A nation of people wondering where God is, wondering, God, why is this happening to us again? We're home, and yet we're still in exile. We're holding on to these suspended promises from the prophets. We're looking forward to that day, or we're trying to, the day of hope, the day when another son of David would come and lead his people in a new exodus, and lead his people in a new rescue. And so Jesus shows up. And in this light, in this context, does some shocking things. A Canaanite woman, for example. So she's Gentile. She's not Jewish. A Canaanite woman calls out to Jesus for the healing of her suffering daughter. And she calls Jesus son of David. A blind man in Mark calls for Jesus. And the phrase he uses, the title, is son of David. A beggar in Luke cries out. And how does he get Jesus' attention? By calling him the son of David. Jesus hears the beggar's cry. He hears everyone's cry. And when the suffering, when the sick, when the blind call out son of David, it's as much of a question, isn't it, as it is a cry? When they use this provocative title, they're saying, are you really him? Are you the one? I mean, just to say the name son of David was to drag up all the memories, all the pain of exile, the oppression, the failure, and it was to drag up the hope, the promises from the prophets that would be fulfilled at some point. And so Jesus keeps insisting that this new kingdom, again, rule, reign of God was coming. He talks about what it looks like with all kinds of parables and all kinds of teachings. He goes around announcing that the kingdom, the reign, the authority of God is now coming near, or it's upon you. Jesus speaks of a new kingdom and then shows what it looks like when God's power, when his authority shows up and it comes to people. He heals the sick. He gives sight to the blind. He helps the lame walk. I mean, the prophet Isaiah said that the Messiah, the servant, would do things like this. When John the Baptist sends his disciples to find out whether or not Jesus, who he really is, they ask a question that gets right to the heart of the matter. They ask Jesus, are you the one who was to come, or should we expect someone else? Are you the son of David? Are you the servant Isaiah talks about? And Jesus says, go back and tell him this. Tell him the blind receive sight. And he goes on and he basically quotes this passage in Isaiah 42 that we read earlier. Clearly, he's claiming that he's the one Isaiah was talking about. So anticipation grows as Jesus goes from town to town. He goes from village to village, teaching and healing and comforting and explaining and announcing that God is doing something new, something big, and something through him. And so massive crowds gather to listen to Jesus. People give up everything to follow him. Children line up in the streets and sing songs about how Jesus is the new son of David. But woven through the Gospels is a much darker part of the story. And this is the thing that the people could not seem to grasp, no matter how many times Jesus said it. In John chapter 12, John writes, "There were some Greeks among those," so again, Gentiles, "among those who went up to worship at the festival. They came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, with a request. 'Sir,' they said, 'we would like to see Jesus.'" Okay, this is interesting in John because John opens his gospel by saying he came to his own, and what happened? His own didn't receive him. And so later on, you have people who are not his own, Gentiles, Greeks, coming to see Jesus. Philip went to tell Andrew. Andrew and Philip, in turn, told Jesus. Verse 23, Jesus replied, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Very truly, I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds." He's obviously hinting at his own coming death. Then he goes on to the same people. He says, "Now is the time for the judgment on this world. Now the prince of this world will be driven out. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." Now's the time for the prince of this world, the Satan, the accuser, in Hebrew, to be driven out. Remember this conflict, this age-old conflict between people subverting God, the enemy subverting God's authority. It's time for that to be done. And this part about him being lifted up for the world is, again, a reference to the cross. And then he says he'll draw all people to himself. The interesting thing here is that that's already happening, isn't it? Because who's come to see him? Greeks, Gentiles. I mean, Jesus takes that itself as a sign that this is beginning to happen, that they are going to be a light through him, a light to the Gentiles. He goes on in John 16, he says, "The prince of this world now stands condemned." And I'm assuming when people heard that, they were like, yes, you know, it's about time. What they had trouble with, though, was the way in which the prince of this world would be condemned. They had these expectations. They had these visions of God coming and setting up a kingdom through this Messiah, much like Rome, much like any other kingdom of the day, with power, possibly, if necessary, with violence. And they see in hindsight, that's not at all what Jesus was about. After Jesus' death and resurrection, as John later on writes, and what the early Christians understood perfectly clearly in hindsight, the reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work. In other words, Jesus and his announcement of God's authority, God's kingdom, is putting him on a direct collision course with the forces and power of evil, and the evil working through the rulers of this world. This is an amazing central passage in Mark chapter 10. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to Jesus. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us what we ask." "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory." Like when you do all this amazing stuff and you establish your kingdom and you take power away from Caesar and Pilate and all these other people. "We want positions of honor and of glory." "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said. "Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" "We can," they answered, rather prematurely. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." And you see at the crucifixion with the one on the right and the one on the left, the thieves, that those places have indeed been prepared in advance, and that James and John have no idea what they're asking or how Jesus is going to be enthroned as king. And then get this. Jesus called them together and said, You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles, that could be Caesar, that could be the Babylonian kings, that could be the pharaohs, I mean, the long, sad story. They lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. That's been the nature of power ever since Genesis 3 when Cain murdered his brother and ran off to build a city and make a name for himself. It's been about corruption. It's been about escalating violence. It says, you know all that. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus understands very clearly that he's fulfilling Isaiah 42. Here's the servant. Here's the suffering servant, the one who's come to give his life. On the night Jesus is betrayed, a group of soldiers come to arrest Jesus with swords and with clubs, which is, of course, absurd, isn't it? He's been out in the open. He's not been hiding. He's like been in the temple courts, you know, for the past week, teaching openly. And the disciples are just outraged by this, and one of them pulls out a sword and starts swinging, and Jesus commands him to stop and says, don't you know those who live by the sword die by the sword? Of course they do. And we've seen this story all throughout human history. We know how that story goes. And then Jesus reminds his disciples that if he wanted to, he could call his Father, who would provide more than adequate military assistance in whatever form he needed. But he says, if I did that, how then would the scriptures be fulfilled that say it must happen this way? It's almost like Jesus says this, if I do this like everybody has done since the beginning of time, how would that change anything? And the only way to break this cycle is to absorb it. That the true Messiah, the true Son of David, the true servant of Yahweh would have to resist ever using power in the form of violence against another human being. This is why when Jesus is brought before Pilate, who is Caesar's official representative, all the power, all the authority of Rome is embodied in Pilate. And Jesus says to Pilate, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. It's not about violence. It's not a kingdom like you guys think. My kingdom is from another place. It's not from this world, but it is for this world. Just like God's kingdom and his will is to be done on this world, on this earth, as it is in heaven. Pilate responds, you are a king then, said Pilate. Jesus answered, you say that I'm a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. What is truth? Retorted Pilate. Pilate doesn't want to hear anything about truth. Let's talk about power. Let's talk about who has the power right now in this situation. For Pilate, the only truth that he knows is the power of the sword. Pilate then has Jesus flogged, beaten. The soldiers put a crown of thorns on Jesus' head. They dress him in a purple robe, the color of royalty. They mock him and slap him in the face, saying, Hail, King of the Jews. John 19, verse 5, when Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to them, Here is the man. And this is all they needed to see. As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, Crucify, crucify. But Pilate answered, You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him. Where do you come from? Pilate asked Jesus. But Jesus gave him no answer. Again, his kingdom is not of this world. Do you refuse to speak to me? Pilate said. Don't you realize that I have power? It's the word exousia. It's the word authority. I have authority either to free you or to crucify you. Jesus answered, You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Notice Jesus doesn't deny the fact that Pilate has power, right? Because we have this delegated authority. God works through human beings. And when people are corrupt, when people rebel against God, he judges those rulers more severely, but they still have the freedom to rule how they will. But Jesus says that power, that authority that you think you have, it actually comes from God. Jesus is claiming that even now, God is the one who's in charge. God is the one who's orchestrating these events. In other words, it looks like Pilate, it looks like Caesar and Rome has uncontested power and authority. And what the gospel writers are saying is, it's at this very moment that the powers of this world are overextending their reach. They're actually going to be their own destruction. They're reaching beyond themselves because they're in the presence of true power. They're in the presence of the source of power. And then verse 14. Here is your king. More literally it says, behold your king, Pilate said to the Jews. But they shouted, take him away, crucify him. Shall I crucify your king? Pilate asked. We have no king but Caesar, the chief priests answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. The entire story of the Bible becomes focused in many ways in this one scene. Here are all the powers of the world. Here are the Babylons, the Egypts, the Pharaohs. Here are the Romes, the Caesars, the Pilates. Here are the powers of darkness gathering in one place that are behind, underneath the rulers of this world. And in direct contrast to that, here's the descendant of Abraham. Here's the one greater than Moses. Here's the true son of David. Here's the true servant of Yahweh. Behold your king. I love that Pilate says, behold your king. I love that he speaks the truth, and despite the fact that he's disgusted with the concept of truth to begin with. What is truth? And he speaks the truth unwittingly. Pilate, Caesar's spokesman, Caesar's hired thug, is under the authority of God despite himself. And as Jesus himself says, you would have no power over me if it weren't given to you from above. And then we have the chief priests, who, much like their forebears in 1 Samuel chapter 18, say, we want to be like the nations. We want to be part of Caesar's empire. They've grown tired of waiting for God to deliver on this promise. They've grown tired of waiting for the son of David, the servant of Yahweh, to show up and to bring God's rule and reign on earth as it is in heaven. And so they're willing to cut a deal with the devil to save themselves. We have no king but Caesar, by the chief priest, whom you might expect to say something more along the lines of, we have no king except God alone. It's this moment of tragic failure. And so Jesus goes to his death with the royal claim above his head, written by Pilate. Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Pilate knows this is provocative to put that sign up, but he does it anyway. I suspect he does it in part as a slap in the face to the Jewish leaders who had been manipulating him as it relates to Jesus, manipulating him quite successfully, I might add. I think he does it perhaps to add to the mockery of the utterly unkinglike Jesus. But from John's point of view, this means that Pilate is saying far more than he knows. Jesus is enthroned as King of the Jews, and more than that, as King of the whole world. The cross is the moment when God takes power, when God reigns over Caesar. From now on, the ruler of this world is judged, and the prince of this world stands condemned. This is the story of how God was going to deal with evil. He would draw it into one place. He would allow it to do its worst at that point. And he himself would go to that place in order that evil might do its worst to him and spend its force once and for all. And the way the gospel writers tell the story of Jesus going to the cross makes this abundantly clear. Listen to this. The greatest religion the world had ever known, combined with the finest system of justice the world had ever known, come together to put Jesus on the cross. The nations rage, as God said they would in Psalm chapter 2. They rise up against the Lord and against his anointed, his son. And God's response in Psalm 2 with all this going on is this: I have set my king on Zion, my holy mountain. Now, though, no longer Zion, which was the temple mountain, you know, with the temple of Jerusalem, but Golgotha, the ugly little hill a bit to the west. The cross makes Golgotha God's new holy mountain. This is where the nations will come and pay homage to the world's true and only king. What's been needed from the start is another Adam. Not an Adam who would again give in to the temptation and take authority, attempt to take authority away from God. This time we needed an Adam who would submit to God and his authority completely in the role of a suffering servant. And in doing so would crush the serpent. But the serpent crusher's victory would have to happen in a specific way. And the only way that that would actually change anything is if the serpent crusher survived death. If the human experienced the worst a human being can suffer and come out the other side alive, absorbing the violence and the rebellion and the decay of humanity and the evil in the world that resulted once and for all. This is why Revelation 12, end of the Old Testament, says, "Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, 'Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God, and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser of our brothers and sisters, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been hurled down. They triumphed over him by the blood of the Lamb.'" The violent death of the Lamb has won the decisive victory over the rulers of the world, including Satan himself. It may have looked like the powers of this world were winning, as if Rome and all that was winning. That's certainly how everyone in Jerusalem would have understood it at the time. But it was actually the other way around. The cross is the ultimate messianic task. It's the last battle. You realize the gospel writers didn't think of the cross as defeat, and then the resurrection is coming along as like a surprise overtime comeback by Jesus. The point of the resurrection is the first immediate result of this victory that was accomplished on the cross. It's the first obvious and immediate result and implication that the victory has been won. Sin has been dealt with. According to this, this is what the accuser has left to say. Nothing. The accuser has nothing left to say. The Creator can now launch his new creation. It is finished. Would you stand with me and we'll pray? Heavenly Father, as we once again try to enter into this great story of redemption, of salvation, that you've invited us to be a part of, Lord, we reflect with gratitude that by your Son, you have rescued us from the dominion, the kingdom of darkness. You've brought us into the kingdom of your Son, whom you love, in whom we have redemption. Father, as we reflect on the cross, as we reflect on the victory, the ultimate victory that was accomplished there, Lord, help us to search our hearts. Help us to ask hard questions about who it is that we're submitting our lives to. Lord, each one of us have stories and memories and pain associated with asserting our own authority, our own rights over and against you. And every single time, it's been a disaster. It's been a mess. And so, Lord, help us in this season to recommit our lives to submit to your lordship, to your kingship and your authority. Lord, give us the faith, give us the wisdom to see that you actually know what you're talking about when it comes to teaching us how to live, teaching us how to receive your life. Lord, we ask for that wisdom. We ask for that righteousness. We ask for that spirit that can only come from you. It's in Jesus' strong and powerful name we pray. Amen. Well, thanks so much for joining us for worship. Grace and peace be with each one of you as you go. And have a great week. And we'll look forward to seeing you back here next Sunday.